This was an order of magnitude greater than, for instance, the 27 ballistic missiles that they fired at al-Assad in response to the targeted killing of Soleimani a couple years ago. The specter of complex and integrated attack makes it complicated by having to look in every direction for every trajectory almost all at once. We are in a new missile age, a new era of missile warfare. These are weapons of choice.
Hey, welcome back to the Modern War Institute podcast. I'm John Ambo, editorial director at MWI, and I'm joined on this episode by Tom Carrico. Like many of us, he was watching closely just days ago when Iran launched more than 100 ballistic missiles, dozens of cruise missiles, and nearly 200 drones in a large-scale attack against Israel. But unlike the rest of us, he watched it through an expert lens because he is the director of the Missile Defense Project at the Center for International and Strategic Studies. He joins me on this episode to provide insights into the practical mechanics of defending against such a large number of incoming missiles and drones. He describes some of the characteristics of the specific air defense systems employed in the operation, and he discusses the challenges of command and control, of coordination and deconfliction, and others that modern air defenses have to be able to overcome. Finally, he shares some of the lessons that we can derive from the successful operation and how they might inform, for example, the way the U.S. military conceptualizes and implements air defense across a variety of operational environments. Before we get to the discussion, as always, a few quick notes. First, if you're not yet subscribed to the MWI podcast, you can find it on your favorite podcast app so you don't miss an episode. And second, as always, what you hear in this episode are the views of the participants and don't represent those of West Point, the Army, or any other agency of the U.S. government. All right, here's my conversation with Tom Carrico. Tom, thanks so much for joining me once again on the MWI podcast.
Great to be here, John.
You were on a couple of years ago. We talked about hypersonic missiles. Russia had launched a couple of them in Ukraine, and it was sort of one of the first operational uses of them. And so we had you on to share some insights on sort of the practicalities of hypersonic missiles. Today, I asked you on to talk about what, you know, I guess the world kind of witnessed a few days ago over the weekend when Iran launched a bunch of missiles and drones at Israel and Israel's the largely successful air defense operation, air and missile defense operation against them. As the director of the Missile Defense Project at CSIS, I imagine you watched it pretty closely. You know, it's the Missile Defense Project, and Iran launched, 146 ballistic and cruise missiles, along with 185 one-way attack drones at Israel. So I wonder if, again, you know, I think you'd have to be living under a rock not to have a general understanding of the broad contours of what happened over the weekend. But I wonder if you can give some of the details that are really important here.
Well, thank you, John. And it's great to be back on. I enjoy listening to your show. You know, I get to direct the Missile Defense Project, as you say, here at CSIS in D.C. And really, since 2015, we've been focused on that full spectrum of air and missile threats that you alluded to. The attack over this weekend, you know, was certainly a pretty good stab. But what we always like to highlight is the specter of complex and integrated attack. There's a theory on the street that the Iranians were throwing a bunch of stuff kind of symbolically, they for political reasons, knowing that the United States and Israel would shoot them down. I am skeptical of that theory. Whenever you throw 330 plus projectiles of any form at someone, you do so with intent to cause some damage. This was an order of magnitude greater than, for instance, the 27 ballistic missiles that they fired at al-Assad in response to the targeted killing of Soleimani a couple years ago. So this was a big attack. I would say that in many respects, we got lucky by having the advance intel and knowing that something like this was coming and being able to posture our forces and be ready. We were also, I would say, fortunate to have the capacity and the capability in theater to be able to handle this. And there was, you know, basically just about everything that Israel had in terms of type, and likewise in terms of the United States, was expended either over the weekend or in recent months with various air and missile attacks. This weekend, according to news reports, this was the first combat employment of the Standard Missile 3. That's an exo-atmospheric ballistic missile interceptor. In recent weeks, we've seen the reported first use of the Standard Missile 6 as well. And of course, Israel used Arrow 2, Arrow 3, David Sling, and so on. So lots of stuff used, a lot also taken down apparently by manned aircraft, tactical aircraft, especially the low and slow flying lawnmowers, the Shaheds that coming in force. So lots going on. Air and missile defense performed about as close to textbook as you can expect, but it also involved and required a large expenditure of our inventory. And so we shouldn't take that for granted or just wave this away. There was a lot of, I think, excellent shooting that was going on, but I don't think it doesn't come without a price.
Yeah, and I want to talk, you mentioned a couple of the systems that were in play, and I want to talk about that because, you know, there's a big context surrounding this, right? There's the April 1st attack, Israeli attack against an IRGC leader in Syria. There's the geopolitical tensions, regional tensions. There's the risk of escalation. There's the role of outside stakeholders in the regional security balance. But I really want to have a very practical discussion about the kind of mechanics of an air defense operation like this. You mentioned some of those, some of the systems, and we're going to talk about those. I wonder if, you know, if on Friday you had been told Iran's going to launch 300 plus drones and missiles at Israel, was it a foregone conclusion that the systems in place in theater would be sufficient to shoot 99% of them out of the air to successfully intercept so many of them? Or did that success rate surprise you at all?
I think you should never take it for granted. Air defense is hard. Counter UAS is hard. This is why I highlighted the professionalism and the marksmanship on the part of U.S., British, Jordanian, and yes, Israeli air defenders and pilots. That this took skill. This took work. Again, being able to take out 330 projectiles of any kind. Admittedly, a few got through. Some admittedly rather minor damage was sustained. But nevertheless, no, I don't think you can take it for granted. It's these things are designed, especially the specter of complex and integrated attack, makes it complicated by having to look in every direction for every trajectory almost all at once. So I think the various air defenders across this this coalition of sorts and of multiple services, both sailors and soldiers and airmen, performed very well here. It's again, this is why I highlighted we were fortunate that there was not greater damage and greater loss of life.
I think most listeners will be most familiar with when they think about Israel and air defense with Iron Dome, right? The system that has generally, prior to October 7th, been very successful in shooting out of the sky most of the rockets that have been launched, or many of the rockets that have been launched from Gaza, for instance. But you mentioned the Arrow 2, the Arrow 3. There's also David Sling. Can you talk about the practical aspects, I guess, of some of these systems and what they're designed to be able to do?
So, first of all, I think it's important to note that the Israel and their development of their several layered air and missile defense capabilities, of which Iron Dome is one of the lower levels, lowest levels, is, in the first instance, it's tailor-made for Israel. You know, any defense design, any air defense design is about what your defended asset list is. And so therefore, in this case, it's tied very much to Israel's geography. It's also tied very much to Israel's, to the various threats, specific threats that are in Israel's neighborhood. And as Israelis like to say, they live in a bad neighborhood. So I say that because Israel does not face an identical threat set that the United States, for instance, has to contend with, say, in the Pacific. They've got a specific threat set, and Iron Dome is, for instance, designed to deal especially with the kind of rockets that have been so plentiful and that have harassed and damaged and killed Israelis from especially Hezbollah and Hamas in Gaza and in Lebanon over the years. I say that because it is, you know, their philosophy to Iron Dome and developing that system and working with the United States to fund it and procure it is their philosophy is different than ours. It's very much in terms of being inexpensive and good enough, as opposed to prioritizing, for instance, a more exquisite capability. And that's good enough. That's the right thing. It's a very sensible thing, you know, given the particular geography, given the particular kinds of threats that they have. So I want to just kind of contrast it. You're right that Israel has been engaging thousands of rockets successfully. Nothing is perfect, of course, but over the years, thousands of rockets have been successfully engaged by Iron Dome and by other systems as well. David Sling has been operationally employed, I believe, both this weekend and in recent weeks, and Arrow 2, which is more endo, and Arrow 3, which is more exo-atmospheric systems as well. So all of these are built for Israel's defense. They've also, of course, got Patriots, and more Patriots that I have heard were employed over the weekend, as well as, I believe, according to news reports, some U.S. Patriot forces as well.
Which of those Israeli systems is the closest corollary, or maybe there isn't one, to the Patriot system in terms of what it's designed to defend against?
First of all, there's several different effectors within the Patriot family. The two large groups would be the PAC-3 family, which is hit to kill, and the PAC-2, which is actually a bigger missile, which is a blast frag. And so there's certainly diversity within the Patriot family, but I think probably David Sling would be sort of just under that, smaller missile, a little bit less expensive, and a version of that, for instance, is sometimes by other partners kind of paired or in the process of being paired with Patriot. I'm speaking specifically of Poland, for instance, what they call the version of the Stunner kind of thing. So that would probably be comparable. Arrow 2 is going to be a little bigger. Arrow 3 is, you know, again, bigger yet and more taking place outside the atmosphere.
Would those be, and you know, I know that these comparisons are imperfect, but would either of those systems be sort of comparable to the U.S. THAAD, the Terminal High Altitude Air Defense System?
Yes, that would probably be Arrow 2, would be kind of comparable to that.
Okay. You mentioned endo and exo-atmospheric missile defense. Can you talk a little bit about the distinctions, what that means when you're targeting, a missile in or outside of the atmosphere?
Yeah, so really it's endo within the atmosphere, exo outside the atmosphere, vacuum of space. And so when I say endo and exo, I'm talking about the interceptors in terms of where they go after the incoming threat. And that matters, for instance, in terms of whether you have air for fins to grip onto. And so, you know, if it is a aerodynamic thing with atmosphere to steer, then that means you can steer aerodynamically. If not, then you are, you know, simply using thrust to be able to do so. So that kind of translates to different kinds of things. Now, I do want to emphasize that really that the diversity and the quantity of different things in this air and missile defense spectrum, but also that it's just so dang blurry. And you keep in mind that the Patriot family grew out of another thing. You might call it kind of the PAC-1, the original Patriot, which was very much an air defense weapon. So in other words, fixed wing type of targets. That's what it was designed for originally. It used to be called SAM-D, and then in 1976 they kind of renamed that program to be Patriot, which is patriotic phased array tracking radar to intercept on target acronym. So I emphasize this because you've seen Patriots not just go after quote unquote missiles, but go after, aircraft, including in the Ukraine conflict, including some PAC-3s reportedly hitting some pretty exquisite Russian aircraft at range.
You know, you've described some of the weapon systems. What about the, what are the mechanics of this sort of operation? Radar detects all of these incoming, you have sensors that detect incoming munitions of various types. How then does the command and control of these various systems, how do you apportion, weapon systems to targets successfully, particularly when you get into a scale like this, there's always the risk that systems can be overloaded or overwhelmed. What mechanism plays that role?
In terms of when you've gone Winchester, as they say?
Sure.
It's the defense design. It's the shot doctrine. Every weapon system is finite, whether it be bullets, whether it be offensive missiles, whether it be gravity bombs. Every weapon is finite, and that's certainly the case when you're dealing with exquisite weapons like this. Aegis ships only have so many VLS tubes, and there's only so many of those that are allocated to defensive as opposed to offensive, so on and so forth. So that is, it really comes down to the commander. They have to make some hard decisions about under what circumstances they would engage, under what circumstances they would not engage. And Israel, for instance, frequently lets errant rockets go into the desert where they probably won't cause damage if it's, not worth expending an Iron Dome, for instance. And so the short answer is, there's no simple answer. There's no perfect answer because you don't know what the future is going to hold. And so you have to have intent in place in advance that under these circumstances, you'll engage with this many missiles. And at this point, you will run out. So that is that's a challenge that we've seen certainly with Ukraine, for instance, and according to news reports of the Russians attempting to saturate and overwhelm, but also attempts to draw fire, right? Perhaps, according to news reports, shooting perhaps old S-200s or S-300s in a surface-to-surface mode, maybe without even a warhead on them, in the hopes that it'll suck up an AMRAAM or it'll suck up a Patriot or something like that, or an IRIS-T in the effort to kind of bleed the air defense dry. So this is why, because these are ultimately finite resources, you can never think about air defense as sitting and playing catch. It is a finite game that fundamentally buys time. It's the temporal aspect of air defense. You can never sit and play catch forever. And so what it does is it buys time for you to win the war, to prosecute the war by other means and end the threat by other means, be it attack operations, be it diplomacy or what have you. And so you saw this in the Red Sea. And for months, the U.S. Was, I would say, for too long. The United States ships were doing a great job of shooting stuff down. But while it was buying time for policymakers to go and do something about the threat, they weren't doing much about it. And unfortunately, we kind of took our time, I would say a little too long, to go in and begin schwacking the quote-unquote Houthis, the proxies in Yemen that were doing so much of this shooting. You got to use the time well that air defense buys you.
And, in terms of I don't want to double down on the sort of command and control aspect of this, but I find it really fascinating because you highlighted a key difference between the Israeli air defense system, which is relatively inexpensive and good enough, versus the sort of exquisite and expensive systems that, probably kind of define the U.S. air defense enterprise. In Israel, how much of that, from the beginning, from the moment these incoming missiles and drones are identified, you've got target identification, you've got to align the weapon systems and and ammunitions to target them, and you've got to give the orders. How much of that in an Israeli context is automated, and how much of it can be automated in a high-end air defense system in terms of letting the algorithms make those determinations about whether or not to expend something to shoot down a missile whose trajectory looks to be impacting in a non-populated area?
Yeah, and you know what we're really kind of getting to is the rules of engagement and how much automation you want prudently to build into that, because you don't want to shoot down an aircraft, a friendly aircraft, passenger aircraft, inadvertently, just because there's some blip on a radar. I would say the description of the Iron Dome, for instance, which has a relatively shorter window of time in which to respond because they are shorter range threats, there is apparently a greater degree of automation built into that. The launchers are in the desert or something like that, first of all, more relatively unattended, but nevertheless very closely networked together. So they have the ability to respond much more rapidly to, you know, when rockets pop up quickly, say from Gaza. Yeah, and they've been doing so for many years. For other longer range threats, of course, you have a little bit greater window of time by definition, almost by definition. And so, you know, for those threats, more expensive effectors, it makes sense to have a person on the loop as opposed to a purely automated engagement. And so, that's prudent as well, but I think it's also important to note, this comes from Moshe Patel, the head of Israel's IMDO, when I had him over for an event last year, a great event last year, which you can find on the CSIS website. That again, back to their philosophy of being good enough and focusing on engagements in the near term at cost effectiveness, that they prioritize and they acknowledge that they have interoperability between their several systems rather than what we kind of prize as true, deep, integrated integration or integrated fire control. And I think it's kind of important to note, to kind of acknowledge that for their threats, that's good enough. And for many air defense systems, that is good enough. Sometimes interoperability becomes a bad word. What we really need is integration. Although that's the meaning of that is worth parsing a bit.
Can I actually jump in, because you used the word layered air defenses, right? And so can you kind of describe the theoretical distinction between having layered air defenses, integrated air defenses, or interoperable air defenses?
Yeah, no, that's good. So layering, especially in terms of different capabilities, say different altitudes, so usually the sequence of Iron Dome, David Sling, Patriot, and Arrow, for instance, that they're engaging different threats, they're engaging different altitudes. But layered or defense in depth really ought to mean, and then sometimes does mean, being able to take multiple shots at the same threat. And so, for instance, an Aegis ship may have for certain kinds of threats, say an SM-6, can reach out a little further, maybe an ESSM or SM-2, and then finally the close-in weapon system, the gun, for last-ditch efforts. And that's probably a better example of true layering in terms of being able to take multiple shots at a single threat or type of threat as for anything that gets through. And you've seen news reports of, in fact, Aegis ships using their close-in weapon system in recent weeks. Now, interoperability and integration, this is actually the topic of a forthcoming paper that I'm working on. The fact that the latest national defense strategy you talked about integrated deterrence means, unfortunately, that every PowerPoint slide developed by DOD now has to have the adjective integrated somewhere on it. And what that's done is to, I would say, the overuse and abuse of the term. Mm-hmm. And it kind of means something different to everyone who uses it. And that's true even in the active air and missile defense realm. And so I like to say the integration fundamentally has many meanings, and its concrete meaning depends upon what things are being brought together and for what purpose. And so integration is bringing things together to work together for some goal. There are different things that can be brought together. You can bring together different sensor pictures to create a common integrated, an integrated air picture, for instance. That is integration. It is different from other things. For instance, plugging an M903, a Patriot launcher, into a THAAD battery, as we now have the capability to do, and firing those Patriots off of the THAAD fire control. Doesn't have the Patriot brain anymore. It's just the Patriot missile and the Patriot launcher that is literally plugged into the brain of the THAAD system, and now is able to launch those, let's say, PAC-3 MSE missiles to a greater distance by virtue of using the THAAD Tipi 2 radar. I know I'm throwing a lot of acronyms around here, but air defenders are well familiar with these systems. So there's lots of different ways to integrate. And I think it's incumbent upon the conversation for, I believe, air and missile defense and for weapons systems generally, is if you want to wave your hand in the direction of integration, please take an additional step to say, what is the function? What is the thing that you're trying to do better? What is the capability that you're trying to do better? What are the things you're bringing together for that purpose? I think trying to do that with a little more specificity would help just a whole lot to improve the conversation. You know, frequently I'll see people talking back and forth about, integration, and it's a Rorschach test. Mm-hmm. One person will talk about, we need to have allies and partners generally talking to each other, information sharing. Okay, that's a kind of integration, I suppose, or interoperability, but they may talk about offense-defense integration, which is a completely other thing to kind of coordinate and synchronize attack ops and active air defense. So I probably need to get off my soapbox on this thing, but I think it's useful to focus on what's the function that your putative integration work is trying to serve, and how are you going to go about doing it?
So for listeners that are trying to kind of wrap their heads around this, is it best to think about integration in a hardware sense? Like once you've got all the pieces in place and you've got the defense organized, that's integration? Or is it more the approach to how we think about procurement and R&D and systems development? Is it one step further removed from the actual implementation on the battlefield?
And the answer to that is it can be all of those things and is all of those things depending upon where you sit. If you are in a PEO, if you're in a program executive office and your job is to buy things and acquire things for the Army, you may think about integration. You may think about integrated planning if you're in the joint staff. All of those things are legitimate ways to describe an effort. But, you're also alluding to the more technical and hardware-focused thing. I talked about putting systems together so that electrons can talk to electrons. One such instantiation is the creation of that integrated air picture or common air picture. Another instantiation of that is, and this is a harder one, integrated fire control. And so integrated fire control in a way takes several components or elements or systems and has a single fire control loop, a single brain, you might say, so that you can better deconflict fires and say, you take the shot, you don't take the shot, as opposed to everybody is just operating on their own and shooting at everything, which we have seen in recent years with some of our friends engaging various threats. There's other ways to do that, of course, by doctrine. If it comes into this sector, I'm going to take it. I'm not going to take it if it comes over in this sector. Those are approaches to a defense designed by other rules. So the short answer is it can mean all of those things. The point I'm trying to make is that I would just encourage folks to be a little more specific about what is the thing that they're talking about when they invoke this secret sauce of integration.
Yeah, it's sort of like multi-domain or all-domain, right? You use a word enough and apply it to enough things, and it loses some of its explanatory value. And you know, as an editor who works principally on defense-related subjects, I spend a lot of time looking at the DoD dictionary of defense and associated terms, I think it's called. And I just did a control F to see how many different times integrate, integration, integrated, some form of that word appears in the dictionary. And it's 137 times, which I think, you know, gives a sense of what happens when we're not disciplined about retaining a core meaning for a particular term and we apply it too widely, because then it loses value, even in the places where we need it to have value the most.
I'm glad you say that, because the a couple CNOs ago, the CNO, I forget what year it was, came over to CSIS and said, I'm going to ban the term A2AD, because exactly what you just said, it means something different to everybody else. And it obscures more than it clarifies.
Yeah, certainly. I want to shift gears a little bit, because, you know, we were talking a little bit offline. I was telling you about a friend that I commissioned in the Army with, who was branched air defense artillery. That was not his top choice. This was in 2006. He spent 3 years in the Army, you know, doing great things for the air defense artillery community, but sort of outside of the theaters of strategic focus, the theaters of operational focus for the Army at the time in Iraq and Afghanistan. And he was left a little bit jaded by that experience. Fast forward, you know, 15 years, and suddenly we're coming to grips with, you know, the fact that we used to always talk about it. But 1953 was the last time that a U.S. soldier was on the battlefield and had to worry about being targeted from the skies. That has shifted so rapidly with the proliferation of drone technologies, one-way attack drones. We've seen, you know, so many lessons coming out of Ukraine. We're seeing lessons coming out of this. What would you say for the operational Army, people outside of the air defense community, what are the biggest gaps that we need to close in terms of institutional understanding about the importance and the role of air defense on a modern battlefield?
Yeah. Well, first of all, there's a period of time, unfortunately, air defense, the ADA, was regarded as a bit of a backwater. That day is gone. It was, for instance, to give an example of this, in 2012 time period post-sequestration, the Army had to make some very tough choices, and to cut costs. And they took, for instance, the SHORAD units out of the regular force and put them into the Guard as an instance, one of a number of instances of the way in which we took air superiority for granted as a joint force, as a country. And boy, did we come to regret that. That was in the 2012 time period. Just 2 years later, in 2014, when stuff started getting real again with Ukraine and the South China Sea, we kind of whirled around on our heels and realized that history had returned. And so think 2017, when Mark Milley unveils the new five modernization priorities for the U.S. Army. He goes through a number of them, and then he gets to, I think it was probably the fifth one, and he says, but none of this matters if you're dead, and that's why you need air defense. And lo and behold, the Army, the U.S. Army has done, I think, a pretty good job of trying to reconstitute and prioritize air defense. And just take a look at the budget, for instance, of the Army air defense and missile defense assets over the past 10 years. We do a lot of budget analysis here at the CSIS Missile Defense Project. Look, by 2027, they're going to be up to about $7 billion just in terms of Army air and missile defense. That's a small missile defense agency. And actually not that small of a missile defense agency. Patriot is getting more attention. What's called the IFPC, Integrated Fire Protection Capability, think cruise missile defense, AIM-9s in a box. Of course, there's some NASAMs that are still out there helping Ukraine, but lots of Stingers. You know, post-2022, when Russia invaded Ukraine again, remember I talked about those M-SHORAD being taken out of the regular force. Well, guess what? First it was the Javelins, but then it was the Stingers that were the star in Ukraine. And we would not have been able to help them if we didn't have them, you know, lying in a warehouse somewhere, you know, gathering dust because, hey, we thought that we had air superiority as an American birthright. And guess what? Not only did we take them out of the force, but we stopped building them because, hey, that's kind of a 1980s thing. Well, that changed pretty quick. And now the Army's on an effort to have a Stinger follow-on effector. Unfortunately, it's not going to show up until probably close to 2030. Those are the wages of taking air superiority for granted. I don't think we're going to make that mistake again anytime soon. The diverse spectrum of air and missile threats from the likes of Russia and China and Iran and everybody else is here to stay. We are in a new missile age, a new era of missile warfare. These are weapons of choice, and I think we've kind of figured that out. I will say that you're right. It was the Korean War that was the last time Americans had worst attacked successfully from the air, with two exceptions. One, in the Gulf War, there was that one missile attack. And then secondly, the Al-Asad air base when Iran attacked with those 27 ballistic missiles. So, but other than that, we've been able to take this for granted, but we can't anymore.
So if we sort of before we close out, if we kind of shift gear back to, you know, what we witnessed over the weekend, anybody who's seen photos and videos, the skies were full, both of these drones, of the missiles and the munitions used to engage them. Also, all of the Israeli aircraft that were up in the sky engaging the drones, and the ones that were just, put up in the air so that they could clear the runways at air bases that they knew were being targeted by these incoming projectiles. When you think about all the systems in place, the different services, ground forces, air forces, naval forces, in this case, it was multinational. What are the deconfliction challenges in terms of engaging masses of targets like that?
That's a very good question. But deconfliction in part because you don't want friendly fire. You want that IFF issue resolved, but you also want to conserve your resources. You don't want two units firing at the same thing, for instance. And I said earlier, there's certainly been instances of that. That's the price you pay for insufficient rules of engagement or insufficient communication, for instance, between units. I suspect that dividing in terms of geography, right? If, let's just say, I'm just going to pick a country, Jordan, you've got this sector, British, you've got this sector, and if you see a Shahed flying through here, what looks like a Shahed, that's yours. And so sectoral deconfliction is one. The other is, of course, by doctrine, by altitude. And so it's fairly relatively easy to distinguish a fast-moving theater ballistic missile from a Shahed. They don't look the same on radar. And so by doctrine, you can have different rules of engagement for that. Now here's, I'll pick a little bone here, that in some respects, the U.S. Army in particular may have been asked to overlearn the lessons of Desert Storm in terms of that friendly fire incident that people still recall. Mm-hmm. What I mean by that is there are certain rules of engagement for ground-based air defense that are more restrictive for soldiers than they are, for instance, for sailors on a ship that might be under attack. The principle of self-defense and the principle of being able to fire at a potentially threatening object. And I think in some respects, we may have overlearned or been told to overlearn that past unfortunate episode, and that may be a challenge. Because if, for instance, I think Tower 22 incident, if, for instance, an adversary is successful at masking their signature, according to news reports, a UAV came in behind one of our UAVs and we didn't identify it. But if they're successful at masking their signature for some period of time and there's less warning, what kind of engagement authority might there be for aerial threats, as opposed to getting, and what I'm alluding to here is asking the Air Force, for instance, for approval to fire. So that I would say I've heard some air defenders talk about this. I think it's an interesting topic and worth consideration, because guess what? If, for instance, an even more wicked, complex and integrated and structured attack comes into an an American base or to Guam, for instance. I said that this attack this weekend was an order of magnitude greater than al-Assad. Think another order of magnitude greater that we may be facing from China or something like that on a very bad day. So not merely putting the systems in place, having the brains talk to each other, having the battle management and decision aids all in place for those wicked hard air defense problems, but also having the rules of engagement. So you don't have to necessarily call the Air Force with comms that may be in question or call Hawaii for approval from higher headquarters. So those are the kind of things that we also ought, I think, to be thinking about.
Sure. Well, Tom, I want to thank you for joining me. I'm cognizant of the time when we're, 3 days after one of the largest air and missile defense operations conducted in recent history. Then I imagine in your capacity as director of the Missile Defense Project, your schedule is quite full. So I appreciate you making a little bit of time to have a conversation today.
Well, thank you, John. And again, I can't end without just, again, acknowledging the skill and the professionalism of the air defenders that managed to pull this off. Yes, these were unscripted, realistic tests of equipment, but they were also remarkable episodes of the ADA and of both soldiers and sailors, performing some truly great feats here.
Certainly, and I think a great point to end on. So thanks, Tom. Hey, thank you so much for listening to the MWI podcast. One last thing before you go. If you aren't following MWI on social media, you can find us on Twitter/X, Facebook, or LinkedIn. It is a great way to stay up to date on all of the new articles, podcast episodes, research, and more that we're publishing every day. Thanks again.